MacCast, Sunday, February 17th, 2019. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. How you doing? Hopefully you have had a wonderful week and things are going well for you. I don't really know if I talk about this. I'm recording the show usually at the end of the week, toward the end of my weekend. Never really know when you're going to be picking it up, but something that often amazes me when it comes to Apple and Mac news, or actually, I guess more of a question that I get asked often in the years that I've done this podcast, is don't you ever run out of things to talk about? And every time I think I might, yeah, stuff happens and I don't. I'm looking over the show notes for the episode for this week, and man, do we have a lot of stuff to talk about. Of course, there have been lots of rumors of things that are coming soon, right? We're all expecting Apple to make some announcements. What those announcements are going to be, though, that's going to cover the bulk of what we're going to be talking about today. So we've got rumors of new AirPods. We've got a little more on that rumored Mac Mini, or iPad Mini, rather, and iPad updates in the news. And then we kind of have details forming about when Apple's announcements are going to be, what the event is going to be all about. And it may surprise you because what we were thinking might not be what it turns out to be. So we'll talk about that a little bit. We're going to also talk about Apple's car project, a little bit on the iPhone ban over in Germany. And then we'll round things out with a bunch of acquisitions and changes to Apple's org chart and what all that means. Kind of analyze what we think Apple is up to and what they might be looking to do in the future. So that'll round out the news for this week. We're also going to get into a conversation about some of the changes at Apple retail, or I guess more specifically, I want to talk about, hey, what changes do we think Apple might want to make at retail now that Angela Ahrens is leaving the company and they're kind of changing things up with the management there. Also want to get into a scam that is out there that I want to warn you about. And actually, a listener gave us a little bit of heads up on. And then also missing email. And we'll talk a little bit about Apple shortcuts, or iOS shortcuts, I guess, and how you might be using those. I had a listener email in and tell me about a way he was using it that I hadn't really thought about. So we'll talk about that a little bit, and then I want to find out from you how you're using shortcuts. And that will round out this episode. So it should be a good one. I want to jump right in, but before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is CashFly. You know, this website comes to you on CashFly's network, but I want to talk to you about CashFly's web optimization solution. You know, when websites don't load, we lose interest. And for each second a page takes to load, it costs a company about 16% in engagement. And fewer visits means fewer customers, and that's not good for anyone. CashFly, though, has your back with their new web optimization capabilities. All of your content will be optimized before it's delivered to your visitors without requiring any development effort from you. And with the recent addition of CashFly's flexible Edge application platform and implementation services, their capabilities reach far beyond those of any traditional CDN. As a matter of fact, CashFly's web content optimization solution includes powerful APIs for solving your content distribution problems, on-the-fly next-generation image optimization, application load balancing, and smart asset delivery. Listen, if your website is directly tied to your revenue, and you know it is, optimize your site's content now. Guarantee the best user experience for all your customers, no matter where they are or what device they're using today. The good people at CashFly are even going to provide a free optimization consultation for listeners of this podcast. That's right, just for you. Know exactly where your site stands today with a Lighthouse score report, and learn how CashFly's web optimization solution can help add 60 points instantly to your score. Visit mac.cashfly.com to get that report. That's M-A-C cachefly.com now. And a big thank you to Cashfly for their support of the show. I guess one of the things that Apple has really been into lately is dark mode. We received that feature in macOS Mojave. We've been hearing rumors about it coming to the next version of iOS. What do you think about it coming to the next generation of AirPods? Yeah, reports are coming out now that the next generation of Apple's AirPods are actually already in production and should be arriving maybe in the next few months, although that even is up to a little bit of debate. But one of the main features being thrown around for the new AirPods is a new kind of finish or material, a little bit grippier, kind of a matte finish or like a soft matte finish for those earbuds, and also potentially a new black color, so available in black or white. I know there's a lot of people who would be very excited about that. I think there are even some third parties out there that will take your current AirPods and change the color, including giving you black ones, although that tends to be pretty pricey. At least one report also mentions improved audio quality with greater bass response that could be coming, and you may remember we've been hearing rumors of potential integrated new health features, things like heart rate monitoring. There's also a rumor that we might get support for, or very likely will get support rather, for Bluetooth 5.0. Now, it is believed that the new AirPods could be released this spring, but there are other reports floating around that say they might not show up until later in the fall, like the September timeframe. We've also, as you know, been waiting on Apple's new AirPower charging mat and, of course, the AirPod wireless charging case. Those things were promised to us almost a year ago, but haven't seen the light of day yet. The reports are saying that even if the new AirPods don't show up this spring, those two products, the AirPod wireless charging case and AirPower charging mat, could arrive sooner, maybe as soon as this March. Now, Apple with the AirPower mat has supposedly had issues dealing with interference and heat issues. Reportedly, those are supposedly solved at this point, but some of the rumors are suggesting that Apple has had to increase the thickness of the design to account for that. So it may arrive and be a little bit thicker than the thing we saw Phil Schiller present to us way back in, September of 2017. The rumors also do suggest a price point, which hasn't been talked about too much. They're saying $150 US for AirPower. That would be surprising. I think that's a little bit lower than what I was expecting. I was expecting it to come in around $200. $150 still is pretty pricey, considering the fact that there are some other third-party products already out on the market that are around that $100 price range and take cues from what Apple has announced. I think that's one of the things that might hurt AirPower is the fact that Apple kind of tipped their hand, which they normally don't do. And again, some third-party products have shown up in recent months, and I think they look pretty good. We talked a little bit about the Nomad one that's out there for around $100. So as far as pricing on the next generation of AirPods, the AirPod 2s, it is expected to remain the same, at least according to most reports, although there were a few of the reports that cited a slightly higher price point at $199. So I don't know if that would be to account for some of the new health features or maybe just the new darker color. I would hope that the price point doesn't go up, but AirPods have been pretty popular, so maybe they could get away with it. I'd like to see them stay at the same price or maybe even get a little bit cheaper. But we'll have to wait and see, and we don't really know at this point when we're going to see that, either this spring or maybe in the fall. But what do you think? Are you excited about new AirPod 2s? Another rumored product we've been talking about a lot lately is that new fifth generation iPad mini. iPad mini is pretty long in the tooth. The iPad mini 4 has been with us for a really long time, and we are expecting Apple to update that model in the next few months. Rumors about the next iPad mini have varied, although the most recent ones seem to indicate that what is old might be new again, or at least that might look the same. And I think a lot of people are actually going to be okay with this. Reports are coming out that the fifth generation iPad mini is not going to change the aesthetic or the size whatsoever. And as a matter of fact, it will also keep a lot of the existing features, including things like the Lightning connector, Touch ID, and wait for it, the 3.5 millimeter headphone jack. Yeah, if you want an iPad with a 3.5 millimeter headphone jack, there is going to be a second option, because I think you can still get it on the 9.7 inch, what Apple simply calls the iPad now. Reports are also saying it's going to have the same bezels and overall size, so not taking on the new design cues from, say, the updated iPad Pros. And the one little design change that they are expecting to come is moving the rear mic to the top center. That would bring it more in line with the current generation of iPad. Big reason for so few changes when it comes to design is that it is expected to have a new lower price. A lot of the reports are almost none of the reports are saying what that price point will be. The current iPad Mini 4 is a bit pricey for old technology at $399 US. Of course, you do get 128 gigabytes of storage for that, but I would hope personally that the updated iPad Mini falls more around the $299 price point for 128 gigabytes. That would bring it in $30 cheaper than the current generation of iPad. That would be the 32 gigabyte model, though. So you get a lot more storage at a little less price than the entry level of a 9.7 inch iPad. And that does seem to make sense, at least in my mind. I don't know what you think about it. But again, that's just my pure personal speculation. The big question is, how far will Apple update the internals, though? You know, what processor are they going to put in there? Currently, I think the current model has an A10. I'm thinking they're probably not going to go with an A12, but you'd hope at least an A10. The question is, will it be the A10 or the A10X. I'm also thinking maybe Apple Pencil support, although again, that's not anything that I've heard in the rumors. It just makes sense given the fact that the latest generation of the iPad, the 9.7 inch model, also does support the first generation Apple Pencil. So I could see them bringing that support, although that might not even happen in an effort to keep the price point down. But I haven't heard from too many of you. I know there's a lot of iPad Mini fans out there. Are you excited about the fifth generation iPad Mini? Does it detract from it if it doesn't get a new refreshed design? Or are you okay with it sort of keeping some of the old touches and just upgrading the performance and internals, maybe bringing the price down a little bit? Shoot me some comments and feedback, maccast@gmail.com. With all these rumors of potential new Apple hardware, you might be saying to yourself, hey, Adam, isn't it about time then for a special event? Yeah, we've been talking actually about it here, Apple doing some sort of spring event, and there is beginning to be strong belief in the Mac community that Apple will hold a special event to announce new stuff on March 25th. The question then becomes, what new stuff are they going to announce? And that seems to be largely up to debate, with the most recent reports leaning heavily towards a services-based announcement and Apple not even announcing or talking about any new hardware. We know that Apple is preparing both a new video service and a news subscription service, something that's going to be rolled into Apple News. And it's expected that the event will focus around either one or both of those new subscription services. The premium news service is expected to come in at about $10 a month for a new subscription, and it would give you pay access to formerly paywalled news websites. So there's a lot of news sites out there, especially major ones like the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the New York Times, who now, if you want to access their content online, you do have to pay a monthly subscription service. The hope is that Apple will do a deal with those companies to bring that content inside Apple News, and you'll be able to subscribe directly from inside the app. The problem for Apple at this point is that publishers are reportedly balking at Apple's new proposed revenue deal, which is 50%. Yeah, Apple wants to take half. That's kind of a significant portion, especially when you consider what they're doing on the app side and also with subscription content inside apps for things like, say, HBO or Netflix, where they take maybe about a 15% cut of the subscription revenue. So 50% would be a pretty big deal. Apple says we'll take half. The other half, that's going to go into a pool. It will be divided up amongst the content providers based on how many people are engaging with their articles. So you have a 50% pool, and then you have even maybe less of that pool that you're going to get. And needless to say, you know, the news services, they're not too excited about that. Many of them, as I mentioned, already have premium services of their own. And another thing they would potentially lose by getting in bed with Apple is access to your subscriber data. Yeah, they like having access to things like your email address so they can further market to you. Now, Apple is really counting on the power of their Apple News app and on their reach with more readers to kind of draw those partners in. Also, those partners still do have the ability to sell ads within their content, and if they sell them on their own, they get to keep 100% of that revenue. If they go through Apple's services to get Apple ads, they get 70% of that revenue. So that's out there. Apple News does reportedly attract at this point about 90 million readers per month. So there is power in that subscriber base. The question then becomes, how many of those would actually convert over to a paid premium news service? And that is the big question. If the success of Apple Music is any indication, though, it could be pretty big. And I think that's what Apple is banking on. At this point, it sounds like Apple hasn't signed up too many news services yet, so I don't know what they would have to announce at the event. There is some speculation that they could announce the service and then have a much later release date, maybe sometime in the fall. There's also news that Apple is working on a separate magazine subscription service that would be rolled into Apple News. That would be another $10 a month subscription service, and it would be based on their recent acquisition of Texture, which is a magazine subscription service app. So that would be, again, rolled into Apple News. Something disappointing about all of this, speculation is that I personally am a little less interested in magazines and newspapers being separate subscriptions. I had sort of assumed that would be all under one monthly subscription service, and it would be about $10 a month. If I had to buy one or the other, I don't know if I would go for either, frankly. I'm not interested in them separate, but you know, I'd ultimately really like to see Apple do a sort of what I've been calling an Apple Prime membership. So more taking on like what Amazon does with Amazon Prime, where you pay one fee and you get a whole bunch of services. I already subscribe to iCloud and Apple Music. I was hoping there would be an offering that would include both of those services along with the newspapers, magazines, and potentially Apple's upcoming video service. That's not out of the question. We are still hearing Apple thinking about that, but that might not be what gets announced in March. It's sounding like it's going to be a news service, and it'll be interesting to see which publishers they have on board, because they have been struggling with that. The other thing that Apple might announce at their March event would be their new video service, although, again, reports are saying the actual content or the actual release of that content might not happen until later in the fall of 2019. This is according to Variety. This whole event is expected to take place at the Steve Jobs Theater on the Apple Park campus in Cupertino, and Apple seems to be inviting some pretty high-powered folks from Hollywood, a lot of the people that are going to be starring in their series and also producing them, and Apple says they could be showing some clips. So we might see people at the event like Jennifer Aniston, Reese Witherspoon, Jennifer Gardner, and even J.J. Abrams. Apple is supposedly also putting together plans to start marketing the new service in advance of a release in the fall, and they reportedly would be not only marketing the service itself, but also starting to market and promote individual shows, something a lot of their partners and content creators that they've been working with are almost reportedly demanding that they do, and it's not something that Apple typically does. We've seen them promote a little bit of a few individual artists through Apple Music, but that's not usually how it goes with Apple. So that's another another interesting little change surrounding this video service. How is Apple going to actually make revenue or get money from that? That's something we've been debating about. There has been this rumor that Apple would offer up their original content for free to existing owners of Apple devices, and that they would plan to sell third-party subscription services from inside the TV app and then take a cut of that revenue, which that sounds like a great way to go. But so far, we're hearing reports that they are struggling there, also signing up partners, that at this point, they only have CBS and Viacom on board. So that would be things like CBS All Access, Stars, and Showtime. HBO is said to be close, but not signed yet, which is a little bit odd to me because HBO already does offer subscriptions through Apple. But Netflix and Hulu, they are the big holdouts, and they may never come on board because, at least with regards to Apple's new subscription or video service, they probably see Apple as a direct competitor. They also, interestingly, are not part of the Amazon Prime service, which has a similar kind of revenue scheme. So they're holding out, and the reason HBO might be holding out is it seems that Apple is once again pushing for their 30% cut when it comes to their new video subscription service. Currently, HBO reportedly only pays 15% upfront, and they probably want that same deal. So whether or not Apple will come down or cave when it comes to this new platform or this new program, that remains to be seen. Again, I think they're banking on the draw of their own original content to bring in a large volume of customers that they can potentially upsell on these other services. So they really have to sell to HBO that HBO is going to get a revenue benefit out of it just by sheer volume. Whether they're able to do that or not, that will be interesting to watch. I think ultimately HBO probably will come on board. Whether or not Apple will have to give concessions, we'll have to wait and see. But again, the more of these services that they can get on board, I think the more attractive the platform becomes. So it's kind of a little back and forth here that Apple is going to have to run through. And it seems a little bit odd that they're getting ready to make an announcement, but maybe don't have everybody signed up or on board, which may be also why we're hearing that the actual release of these services is a bit delayed, that they're going to kind of tease us with them, say, hey, these services are coming. Here's the content that we're going to have. This is how amazing it's going to be. And that might be also part of their strategy to maybe push some of these deals forward, because they're going to get a lot of press coverage. They're probably going to get a lot of buzz out of it. And that may give them a little bit more leverage in the negotiations. But the benefit to consumers, of course, would be consolidating all of their streaming services and payments under a single source. The one other part of the announcement that I read this week that disappointed me a little bit is that in order to get more excitement around the content, that Apple may be ditching their family-friendly content rules to get more creators on board and bring on folks that maybe blocked some of the earlier projects and things that they've been working on. I'm a little bit sad to see the loss of that, because I think there is a little bit too much adult content in a lot of the services like HBO and Showtime, even some of the others like Amazon and Netflix. It gets pretty violent, pretty sexual in terms of the content, and I think we could use a lot more family-friendly stuff. Although I have noticed on some of those services, things are getting a little bit better. But that's just my personal opinion. I know there's room for all of it, but the idea that Apple was going to be kind of that alternative to the gluttony of some of that other stuff on some of the other services, that kind of excited me. So the fact that that might go away was a little bit disappointing. But overall, I'm super excited about the announcements, other than the fact of we're probably not going to see any new hardware. The question becomes, do we actually need an announcement for some of this hardware? We talked about the AirPods getting an update. That might be significant enough. The AirPower Mat, I think Apple, you know, they kind of gave the fanfare on that a long time ago. They could get away with that with just a press release. And same thing with the iPad mini, especially if there's not really some big design changes. So probably these things could happen in just a simple press release alongside the announcement of the services stuff, or potentially, I guess, Apple could also do a separate event, although in my mind, that seems a little less likely. So beyond that, what do we see for the future of 2019? Well, our favorite analyst, Ming-Chi Kuo, dropped some bombshells here late on Sunday. I don't remember him doing late Sunday sort of announcements, but he sent out research notes, and he's expecting some pretty big things from Apple in 2019. And I mean big in terms of size. He says that Apple will produce a 16 to 16.5-inch MacBook Pro in 2019. And I would imagine screen size wise, you know, that's getting pretty close to probably the 17-inch MacBook Pro that we lost many years ago. And I know there's a lot of fans of that big screen model out there. He's saying that the system is going to be aimed at hardcore gamers. I find that a little bit interesting. And also pro designers. Although the hardcore gaming thing, we did talk last week about the rumors that Apple might be working on a subscription video game service. So maybe that could play into that somehow. But I know pro designers, they like those big screen laptops, and you might get one of those in 2019 from Apple. He also says that Apple is going to release an easy to upgrade Mac Pro. We knew Apple was working on a Mac Pro, and we were expecting it to be modular and upgradable. And also that Apple was going to bring out a new Apple display. Until now, we haven't had many details on that. Ming-Chi Kuo says it's going to be a 31.6-inch, rather, a little dyslexia there for you, sorry, 31.6-inch 6K, 3K Apple display. So should be an amazing display and something that will pair very nicely, I'm sure, with that new Mac Pro. He also talked a little bit about new iPhones and new iPads, mentioning things like bilateral wireless charging, meaning that, you can charge them in both directions. So you can use your iPhone to charge another iPhone or vice versa. So they can either charge or be charged. He also reiterated the rumor of a triple lens camera system and also mentioned larger batteries and frosted glass. So there seems to be this move to smooth or glass materials that are a little more textured, a little more grippy. A complaint that has often been levied against the iPhone is that without a case, it's a little bit slippery. And he also says, and this was probably to me the most interesting rumor or part of his note, that he expects them to retain the Lightning connector on the iPhone. Many of us, I think, believe, and I really kind of think it's time that the iPhone should move to a USB-C connector. And with the iPad Pro using USB-C, it seems to make sense, but he's saying, nope, that's not going to happen. And then finally, on the iPad front, he says that the iPad will be bumped up in size to 10.2 inches, and also does mention again that an iPad mini 5 is coming, although I think he thinks it's showing up later in the year. He doesn't give a specific time frame, just says later in the year. So I guess that still technically could be spring this year, but maybe even later. Who knows? I think we are going to get it in spring. And again, as mentioned earlier, probably just a quiet announcement around the time of that March 25th announcement. So what do you think of all this? Pretty exciting stuff. Would you like to see more hardware? Are you excited about the 2019 iPhones? I'm certainly excited about the Pro stuff. For me, in my mind, I don't think it can get here fast enough. I think it's also already way overdue, right? The Mac Pro and the new Apple display. I almost called it a cinema display. I don't think Apple's going to call it that, but that would be kind of cool. Bring that name back. And, you know, really impressive, the new 16.5-inch MacBook Pro, that would be very, very exciting. I can't even imagine what the price point on that is going to be like, though, right? Crazy. Anyway, exciting times for Apple, and I'm starting to look more and more forward to 2019. The California DMV published their self-driving car disengagement reports for the period of December 2017 to November 2018. And in case you're asking yourself, hey, Adam, what the heck is disengagement and why do I care about the California DMV report on self-driving car disengagement? Well, one, because we know that Apple is working on self-driving car systems and they've been testing cars here in California. And also, two, disengagement is when the self-driving car turns control back over to the human operators. Now, these reports include both when the system itself hands control over or when a human actually has to step in and take control. And overall, at least on the surface, the numbers aren't looking good for Apple when compared to, say, some of their competitors. As a matter of fact, Apple came in last in terms of, or I guess, first, they had the most disengagements of any other company that is testing cars here in California. So it is worth noting that this data is self-reported. So we are trusting the companies reporting the data to use their own systems. And that's where maybe some of these discrepancies come in. At least that's what Apple says. Apple logged 871.65 disengagements per 1,000 miles or 1.1 miles per disengagement. Compare that to Google's Waymo, which logged just 0.09 disengagements per 1,000 miles. That's 11,154.3 miles per disengagement. Now, Google's been working on it a bit longer than Apple, and it does look pretty bad. But remember, as I said earlier, a lot of this is in how the companies are actually reporting those numbers. And as a matter of fact, Apple published a document on the DMV website that says their numbers are extremely conservative in reporting their disengagements, at least initially they were, and that likely skewed the numbers. They overreport versus other companies, according to Apple. And the fact that in June, and in fact, rather, in June, they changed their methodology of identifying disengagements. And for the period after June 2018, they had just 28, what Apple is calling now important disengagements, and achieved a 2,004 mile per disengagement number, much, much better. Still not up to the 11,154 miles per disengagement of the Waymo, but certainly better than 1.1 miles per disengagement. So Apple saying, you know, we're focusing really on safety and making sure that our cars are super, super safe out there. And, you know, we're doing it a little bit differently than everyone else. And that's why these numbers really should be taken with a grain of salt. So I don't think they mean very much. I wanted to talk to you about it a little bit because it did come up in the news this week, and also point out another kind of cool little thing that came up was a patent that Apple had filed, again, focusing on the safety of autonomous vehicles. One way they're hoping to make these cars safer is with vehicle-to-vehicle communication. They filed a patent for a wireless vehicle system for enhancing situational awareness, basically sensors on the car or communication devices on the car that would allow different cars on the road to talk to each other and give positioning data and more information that could be fed into the system so that they can make smarter decisions based on what's happening with the other vehicles that are around them. So kind of a little, I guess, mesh network going on the road, and that would be great. I have a feeling it's going to be a challenge, though, if cars stay proprietary in terms of their systems. And maybe that's what Apple's Project Titan is all about, because they're supposedly developing an autonomous vehicle system that they may license or sell to other companies. So if Apple can kind of build out a platform that is used universally, big challenge, yes, and no doubt, with different car companies competing, but maybe they can start to set some standards, and maybe there's some sort of base level of functionality that all the companies could get together, maybe form a consortium and share in that kind of technology. And maybe this could be part of that, whether Apple would require licensing of this patent or whether it was something they would make available to other manufacturers. Who knows? But it could be very interesting, and it does seem to make a lot of sense. So here's a little update on Apple's car project. I have a little update for you on the German iPhone ban. Apple is once again able to sell the iPhone 7 and iPhone 8 in Germany. This is after, as you may remember, a German court ordered that there was an import ban on the devices back in December. The ban was ordered when a judge ruled in favor of Qualcomm in a dispute over a cellular-related patent involving the Intel modems that Apple had been using in some of their devices. Apple is now getting around the ban by simply selling versions of those devices in Germany that use only Qualcomm modems. So should be able to be back getting an iPhone 7 or iPhone 8 in Germany at least sometime soon. I don't know if they're immediately available, but they should be making their way back into the country. Apple not super happy about sort of being forced to use Qualcomm modems. But again, if they want to continue to sell those models of iPhone in Germany, and I imagine that they do, obviously they do, this is how they're going to have to do it. And then finally in the news for this week, a number of little tiny stories dealing with acquisitions and changes in Apple's org chart. We're going to kind of flip back and forth between one and the other, starting off with Apple promoting their Senior Director of iPhone Partner Marketing, Fred Casanova, to Senior Director of Worldwide Product Marketing. Doesn't sound like a huge change, except that in the process, they also changed a little bit of his duties and added in the role of being in charge of, quote, all aspects of product marketing for Apple's augmented reality initiative. They added that to his list of responsibilities. So just another indication that Apple is pushing a little bit harder on augmented reality as part of their future product plans. Apple also reportedly acquired a UK digital marketing startup called Data Tiger. It's not really clear what Apple's plans for the company is, but obviously Apple does a lot of marketing and builds marketing into a lot of its products for its developers, for its advertisers and publishers. They've got, you know, the new subscription services coming up. So this could be the kind of technology and kind of company where they could roll some of that into those services. Apple also reportedly acquired a San Francisco voice startup called Pullstring. This is in a deal believed to be worth around $40 million. Originally, the Pullstring company started out creating interactive voice apps for children's toys, including, I think, the Talk to Me Barbie. And they recently expanded into Internet of Things products, targeting the Echo and Google voice assistant products. So it's very likely that Apple is acquiring this company to bring the technology into things like Siri and maybe ultimately into products like the HomePod. And then finally, Apple has also hired Sam Jadala, a founder of a failed smart lock company, Otto, and also a former vice president from Microsoft. CNBC says that he will be working at Apple on Apple's home products and also says that he might be stepping up to lead Apple's home team and, again, focusing on HomeKit and home automation. So almost all of these changes to me seem in some way to point to Apple's drive to more and more focus on software and services. I guess there's a little bit of hardware maybe rolled in there as well. I think they should bring some short-term improvements to things like Siri and HomeKit, something that I am personally very excited about. Anytime those products can be improved, I'm all for it because I like using them, and the better they get, the happier I am. Also, more longer term, though, I think it does show the trend toward a change in how we're going to be interacting with computers and technology in the future. I've talked a lot about screenless-based interfaces or device-independent computing, basically having smaller integrated devices, maybe wearables and those sorts of things that are going to replace more traditional items like laptops and tablets, especially on the mobile side of things, also your phone. You know, if we really start thinking about it, 20 years from now, are we really going to still be using something that looks like a smartphone or a tablet as we know it today? I think likely not. I think it's going to be some sort of combination of different wearable devices, integrated services, the cloud. All of those things are going to come together, and it's going to be much more common with day-to-day computing. I've said it before, you know, what does the future look like when we take away mice and trackpads and keyboards? And I think that's a lot of what Apple is thinking about at this point with augmented reality, virtual reality, glasses. I don't know what those things are going to be. We've seen little hints of what they might be. Nothing that's been really cohesive. And if I know anything, I know that Apple seems to be pretty good at tying all this stuff together. A lot of other companies maybe throw stuff out there, try things, take risks publicly. I think Apple does a lot of that stuff behind closed doors. And I think they are the ones that tend to figure out how does this thing work as a really good consumer product that consumers are going to take to, and it's going to drive the industry or the next generation of the thing forward. And I think they will do that in this space. Note also that when I say, you know, screenless interfaces or voice-based interfaces and things like mice and keyboards and trackpads going away, I'm just saying as the primary form of interacting with computers on a day-to-day basis. I don't think they're going away fully. I think there's always going to be a place for those, but it's going to become more and more specialized. You're going to have certain applications where you pull those things out or turn to those. But more often than not, especially when it comes to mobile computing, I think we are going to be moving to other kinds of interfaces. But I'm happy to hear what you think. If you think I'm totally bonkos, let me know. But again, I'm putting this in like a 20-year time frame. So I'm not talking about this happening in the next 5 years, maybe not even in the next 10 years, but a little further out, I could see that happening. I think we're already starting to, especially with things like the HomePod and Siri and other voice assistants, we're seeing the beginnings of that, right? And who knows how all this stuff is going to work, but I think it's going to be very, very interesting times. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another show sponsor, and that is ExpressVPN. You know, with all the recent news about security breaches, it's hard really not to worry about where your data goes. I know I worry about it. And beyond even just making purchases online or accessing your email, your private information can be at risk. Even if you're not using public or unsecured Wi-Fi, social media sites, marketing companies, your mobile apps, your internet service provider, they're all looking to find ways to actually track you. We've heard reports about this. They can not only record your browsing history, but they often take that information and sell it to corporations who want to profit from your information. So a great way to get your privacy back is to use ExpressVPN. I've actually been using it, and it makes it very easy to protect your data and privacy when you want to. What I love about it is it's simple to install. It's simple to turn on. It runs seamlessly in the background. Just a simple click and you're on a VPN. It's securing your traffic and your data. They do make it really easy. It secures and anonymizes your internet traffic by encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address. So when you're using public Wi-Fi and you want to keep hackers and spies from seeing your data, ExpressVPN is the solution. ExpressVPN is rated the number one service by TechRadar, and it comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Best of all, you can start protecting yourself with ExpressVPN for less than $7 a month. So protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 free months at ExpressVPN/MacCast. That's ExpressVPN.com/MacCast for 3 months free with a 1-year package. Visit ExpressVPN/MacCast to learn more. And a big thank you to ExpressVPN for their support of the show. I believe it was last episode when we had the story about Angela Arendt's leaving Apple retail. And over the past week or so, I've been reading a lot of stories and seeing a lot of back and forth in our community of folks starting to discuss the retail experience at the Apple store. We've talked about it quite a bit here on the MacCast, I think, over the past year. I even mentioned the fact that many of us have sort of felt the changes at Apple retail, and not always maybe for the positive. There's a lot of really positive things going on, but there's also a lot of places where I think a lot of us could see room for improvement. And with the changeover happening, there's a lot of people, and I think rightfully so, starting to ask questions about, you know, what will change now? What is going to happen? We have a new, more people-focused person coming in. Angela Arendt is historically very much on the retail side of things, focused on a lot of the things that she was focused on. And I think she made some great improvements to the Apple store, both in terms of the experience and what's happening in terms of changing how and why you might go into an Apple store with the whole Apple Today or Today at Apple program. And I think it's cool, exciting stuff. But on the flip side of that, I think many of us have felt that some of the changes haven't been as positive on the customer service side, right? The Genius Bar side of things. And we've talked a lot about these on the MacCast, so I don't want to get into those too much. But they are starting to also bubble up to the surface in our community. Complaints about crowded stores, long lead times to get appointments at the Genius Bar. We know about all of these things. So I thought now would be a good time for us in our community here at the MacCast to talk about these things a little bit. And I'd love to hear from some of you on some of these things. So I want to talk about a few of them. One of the places I want to start with is Today at Apple. What do you think of that program? Are you going into the Apple retail store to take advantage of these things? Have you gone? Have you ever been to a session? Do you like the sessions? What are you finding works? What are you finding doesn't work? I personally haven't been to a session yet. I probably should. I think there's some fun ones that are going on. I'd love to maybe take some of the photography ones or video ones, things like that. But I haven't personally been to one. I did try a summer camp with my daughter, one of those sessions, and I thought it was great. She ultimately wasn't her thing, but that's not a knock on Apple's program. It just wasn't what she was into. But I thought it was run really, really well. I thought the guy who did it did a great job. And, you know, I, as a kid, totally would have enjoyed it. So, and I've heard nothing but positive things. So if the Today at Apple sessions are running like that, and I have kind of seen them by proxy, I've been in an Apple retail store when they're going on, and people do seem to be engaged. They seem to be excited about what they're learning, and they seem to be run pretty well. And I know they, at some of the flagship stores, even bring in kind of celebrities and well-known individuals to kind of teach some of these courses and show them off. So I think it's a great program. I think it's a great excuse to get into an Apple retail store on a more creative side of things, not just being there because you have a broken iPhone or, you know, something's wrong with your Mac, which isn't always, again, exactly the most positive experience, right? You're already going in there with a little bit of frustration looking for a resolution. But let's talk about that side of things a little bit too. You know, getting a Genius Bar appointment is pretty much impossible at this point, and that definitely is frustrating. I know I've talked about it on the show. I've personally resolved myself to always almost go in and just try to get an in-store appointment, you know, like a walk-in appointment. I, knock on wood, have generally been successful with that, but I know I've heard from many of you who have said, that doesn't work, Adam. You know, that doesn't work at my store. And it may vary by region and by store to store. And so there is a lot of conversation and debate going on in our community. How does Apple change that? What are some of the things that they could do to make that experience better? Again, with this changeover, maybe a refocus back on the customer and the customer experience as opposed to improving the retail experience, which has gotten pretty good. Like the retail side of things, I think the layout of the store, how things are sold, being able to pre-order online and not have to do the, you know, long lines at a product launch so you get the product that you want. I think these are all very positive things, the Today at Apple sessions, all that stuff. But what about that customer service experience? Well, a lot of people are crying, just open more stores. There's just not enough stores out there to service all the customers that need to be serviced. And I could see that. That might help. To put this a little bit in perspective, here's some numbers for you. Apple Retail has 70,000 employees at 506 stores worldwide. That sounds like a lot, but it really is small if you compare it to a thing like, oh, I don't know, Best Buy stores or Starbucks or something like that, right? But still, that's a lot of retail stores. They actually service 500 million visitors per year. So there's a lot of people going through the Apple retail stores, and I think a lot of us have felt that. That's what a lot of folks are talking about when they're saying, hey, these stores are crowded, they're always busy, it's kind of crazy and chaotic in there. But I'm not sure just opening a bunch more retail locations would solve those issues. It's probably just going to end up being more of the same and maybe not cost effective for Apple. So it's an interesting thought. Maybe it could help, but I think ultimately it wouldn't do very much. One thing, and I think I might have mentioned this on a previous show, but one thing that I heard that I've been thinking a lot about that I think could be interesting, and bear with me because it sounds bad at first, is I read somebody's article, and I wish I could remember who so I could give them credit, but they basically said maybe Apple should do more like car dealerships do. And you think, oh my God, the car buying experience or car dealership experience is pretty awful. But that's not what they're talking about. They're talking about the fact that car dealerships really separate their service department from their sales department. Yes, they're in the same physical location, but they're really kind of separate experiences and you have them in separate parts of the business. In some cases, they might even be in separate locations. And I kind of like that idea. You know, we have Apple retail stores, which have been sort of rebranded as these town squares, these places to go hang out and check out the products, you know, shop, do some window shopping, maybe come to Today at Apple session, learn some things, just kind of have a good creative time. And the Genius Bar, the Genius experience hasn't been changed in the same way. So I was kind of thinking maybe we should have like Genius lounges, like really comfortable places you can come sit around and wait. Maybe they could even offer coffee, snacks. You could have a little cafe. Maybe you have Apple TVs showing some of Apple's TV content, so you have something to do while you wait for your appointment. And you could place them next to or near the Apple store, but really separate those customers from the retail customers, the people who are just coming in to buy a new iPhone or pick up an Apple Watch or something like that, and create these wholly separate experiences. And maybe that's how you expand. So you're not just opening up a bunch more retail locations, but you're adding kind of this new feature to the experience. And again, you could place them next to, you could even maybe have some of the Genius lounges in places where you don't even have Apple retail stores. So you could have more customer service locations and fewer actual retail locations. Interesting idea, something to think about. Will Apple do that? I don't know. But what do you think about that? Would that potentially solve some of these problems? At the very least, it might be a way that Apple can kind of craft a different user experience and have an environment where it is more focused on the customer and the customer experience as opposed to maybe the selling experience. And I know Apple retail stores, even on the retail side, I think they do a better job than many stores in actually creating a great, enjoyable buying experience as well, a retail experience. But, you know, again, these are kind of separate things. And if Apple could have managers and people focusing in a different direction that's more specific, and I'm sure internally at the Apple store, again, I don't know everything that goes on in there. I'm sure there are these silos, but I'm talking about putting up a kind of even bigger wall between those two divisions. And, you know, that may help. I don't know. It's an interesting thing to think about, I think, at the very least. Now, that said, I have been asking you to share your recent Apple retail store stories with me, your experiences at the Genius Bar and that sort of thing. And I have to say, you know, overall, I'm still getting stories that are mostly positive. Most of you out there seem to be having positive experiences, even at the Genius Bar, even if it does take longer or a little bit harder to get an appointment. Once you're in there and talking to someone, Apple is generally taking care of you. Now, occasionally, I am hearing situations where it took maybe multiple calls or multiple trips, or you had to escalate your case up. You know, you had to talk to a second tier or ask for a store manager. But in the majority of cases, it does sound like Apple is still looking out for their customers and taking care of you. If you think I'm wrong on this, you have a different experience and you want to share that with us, shoot me an email, send me an audio comment, mattcast@gmail.com. And also just generally, how do you think Apple should be changing the experience at retail? You know, what needs to change? What's working? Let's have a conversation about it. Again, mattcast@gmail.com. Here's a situation that is a little bit of a cautionary tale, and also, again, one of these stories where Apple ultimately stepped up and I think took care of their customer. Received an email from Wayne. He sent me an email detailing something that happened to him where somebody tried to basically scam him. He was contacted via email, and it was an email that looked like it was from a friend of his asking him to send $400 worth of Apple gift cards. He being the good friend that he is, I wish I had friends like this. He went so far as to actually go down to the Apple retail store. He purchased the cards, but luckily for Wayne, he thought for a second, you know, before I send these off, I probably should check with my friend via the phone. So he rang up his friend, said, hey, I'm about to send these to you. And the friend, of course, as you might have guessed, had no idea what he was talking about. Yep, it was a scam. And Apple actually, after Wayne sent me this email, I did a little searching, and Apple actually has details specifically about gift card scams or iTunes gift card scams on their support site. I will link to this in the show notes at mattcast.com because it has a lot of useful information about what you should do if you've been hit by one of these scams or someone tries to take advantage of you with one of these scams. They actually have an 800 number you can call, 800-275-2273. And when you get the prompts, just say gift cards and it will get you to someone or some information about how you can deal with being targeted by one of these scams. You know, it kind of sucks that these kinds of people are out there trying to take advantage of people. But again, I think awareness is the key here. And so I really thank Wayne for sharing his story with us because it's going to help all of us become more aware of what's going on. So as I said, luckily Wayne didn't send the gift cards, but unfortunately he had purchased them. And I say unfortunately because with Apple gift cards or iTunes gift cards, they are not refundable. So now you have $400 locked up inside Apple gift cards. And that's great if you were planning an Apple purchase, but in Wayne's case, he wasn't. So he really wanted to get a refund. And he was told on the phone that if he went into the store, unfortunately, he was told this, that if he would go into the retail store, they could take care of him. Ultimately, no, they couldn't. There was nothing they could do for him because, again, Apple's policy when it comes to gift cards is that they're non-refundable. You can use them for purchases, but they won't give you your cash back on them. Now, as I said, ultimately, Wayne was able to get a refund, but he did have to jump through some hoops. He had to call Apple support a few times. He had to get to the right person. I assume the fraud team. So I think if you actually go through that number I mentioned earlier or the link that I'll have in the show notes, you might be able to get this resolution quicker, again, if you've been hit by this scam. But the hoops he had to jump through, even after reaching a person and finding out, yes, we can get you a refund, he was told, well, you're going to have to file a police report. You're going to have to send us copies of that report along with copies of your receipt and pictures of the front and backs of the gift cards that you purchased. Do all of that, and we will be able to issue you a refund check, but it is going to take about 4 to 6 weeks for you to receive that. Well, Wayne actually got the check in about 2 weeks, and so all in all, it was a happy ending, but again, a good warning to all of us to kind of be leery out there, right? If something seems odd or strange, it's always worth just like checking with the source, right? Go to the person who you think the email is coming from and say, hey, you know, this is a little bit odd. I've received text messages from people, even had it happen to me recently with my Instagram account. Someone was trying to impersonate me. They created a fake account that looked like my name and then was kind of, they were kind of reaching out to people in my Instagram list, trying to lure them into something. We don't know what kind of scam, but luckily a listener alerted me to it really pretty quickly, and I was able to jump on top of it, contact Instagram's fraud department, and they shut the account down pretty quickly. So, you know, just, you know, keep your head up out there, and I think ultimately you can avoid these things. But more and more, we're seeing Apple folks get targeted, especially with these kinds of phishing scams. And so thank you, Wayne, again, for sharing your story and helping raise awareness here in our community. Another email I received this week came from Fred, and he actually had a question that I get asked pretty frequently, especially when people transition from a POP-based email account to an IMAP account. And I'll even sometimes get this from folks who have been on IMAP accounts for a while. But what was happening with Fred is he had an old AT&T POP email account, and they transitioned him to a new IMAP account. And that went fine. Everything was working. He's using his email and bouncing along. But not long after the transition, he did start to notice that he was no longer seeing some of his emails on his iPhone or iPad. They were still over there on his Mac in a archive folder that he was moving them to, but he wasn't noticing them or wasn't able to find them on his iPhone or iPad. And some of you probably already know what the issue is, but I don't think this is something that is real obvious to everyone. What was happening was Fred was getting the emails from his IMAP account on his Mac and then moving them into an archive folder that he had set up. But that folder or mailbox actually happened to be in the On My Mac section of his email, not under one or not under specifically his IMAP account. And this can happen, especially if you originally set up some of these folders under POP. Very often, you'll have these On My Mac folders. And what I'm talking about is if you look in the sidebar when you're using the Mail app on the Macintosh, you have your accounts, and the accounts have different mailboxes, you know, things like your inbox, of course, and your trash and your sent box. But then you can also have other mailboxes, or they look like folders, but they're actually mailboxes, right? You create a new mailbox and it shows up as a little folder in the sidebar, and you can, you know, archive or organize mail that you receive into those folders. Well, in those sections, there also is a section called On My Mac, where you can actually create mailboxes that are specifically local to just your Macintosh. And so if you create new mailboxes or folders under the On My Mac section, and then you take emails from your, say, inbox on your IMAP account and move them into that on my Mac folder, what you're basically telling the system is, I want to take this email out of IMAP, off the IMAP server, and I want to put it locally on my Mac. And once you do that, then it is not in the IMAP server anymore, and that means it's not available to your other devices, right? And I think some of this gets confusing because when you have a POP account, oftentimes those are set up to leave the mail messages on the server. And when you do that, then every device that you get an email on, it gets a copy of that email. And whatever you do with that email on that device stays with that device, right? So IMAP is a bit different because all of your email is intended to stay and live on the IMAP server. That way, any actions that you take, even on your email locally, those actions, as long as you stay inside that, you know, IMAP account, those are synced across the server. So if I move it to another folder, if I delete it, if I flag it, whatever it might be, all of those changes are synced across all of my devices. So that is what was happening to Fred. Luckily, to undo it is pretty easy. The fix is just create a folder, really a mailbox, on the IMAP server, and then move all your messages there. So move them from the On My Mac section, literally by dragging them from that into a new mailbox that you would create under the IMAP account on the server. So the way you do that is on your Mac in Mail, under the Mailbox menu, you just choose the option that says New Mailbox. And you might see it default to On My Mac in the Location section. So in the Location section of the New Mailbox dialog, you want to make sure that you pull that drop down and you select the IMAP email account, basically your server, as the location where you're going to create that new mailbox. And then give the mailbox a name. You can name it whatever you want, something like Saved Emails or maybe My Project, and then click OK. And that will create a new mailbox on your IMAP server. And now you can simply drag any emails from any mailbox in the On My Mac section into that new IMAP mailbox, and it will copy it up to the server, and then it will sync and be available to any other device that is accessing that IMAP account. And I personally use this all the time with all of my email accounts. I am a big inbox zero person, so I don't like any mail in my inbox. I know there's folks out there, and this is perfectly fine if you're this type of person. You can leave everything in your inbox, and it will sync just the same when you have IMAP accounts. It's just everything is going to be in your inbox. I like to have an empty inbox and then organize all of my emails into additional mailboxes that I create on the IMAP server. So I have a ton of IMAP mailboxes or folders that I use to organize all my emails into projects, tasks, those sorts of things. So, you know, when I get emails from you on the MacCast, I put those in various boxes to follow up on, to do things with, or just into an archive that I keep of all those emails. And it helps keep my emails not only organized, but also make sure, because they're on that IMAP server, that they're available across all of my devices when and where I need them. Of course, the one caveat here is you do need to have enough storage on your IMAP server, but as long as that's available to you, you can do that. And when you do run out of storage, you might consider archiving those, sort of doing the opposite, taking them off your server, your IMAP server, and putting them into an On My Mac folder and just having them in one location at that point. Of course, you'll want to back those up and have them as part of your backup scheme, but you get my point, is you could archive them to your Mac, pull them off the IMAP server, free up some space, and then still have access to them from your Mac. Of course, they're not going to sync across and be available on all of your devices, but again, you're saving storage. So that's what was happening with Fred, and I thought it was worth bringing up because it does come up, you know, many times throughout the year. I'll get a very similar email. So thank you, Fred, for your email. All right, I want to finish up the show for today, kind of following up a little bit on something that I talked about, I think, here and also on the iOS show. You know, that show that we canceled, quote unquote? Yeah. Every once in a while, there's still episodes coming out on that feed. So if you unsubscribed, you might want to resubscribe to it, because Michael keeps pulling us back in for shows from time to time. We're doing maybe one every month or so. So it's not as frequently, but iOS show's still around, despite the fact that we told you it was canceled. And so sorry if you missed that. But I was mentioning, again, here and there, that I have recently been having kind of intermittent issues with my AirPods, specifically with the battery, in some cases, seeming to not last as long as it used to, and also occasionally with it losing connectivity. Specifically, I talked about the fact that there's this one spot in my neighborhood when I'm doing my exercise, when I'm trying to close my rings on my Apple Watch, I'll walk to this one specific area, and it's not all the time, but very frequently, I will lose connectivity just in this one spot. And then once I leave that one spot, I'm able to connect again and everything works fine. So I've developed my own conspiracy theories about why this is. You know, San Diego is a military town. We've got the Navy. We've got the Marines. They do a lot of kind of testing of gear and equipment. I'm not saying this is what it is, but, you know, top secret weapons jamming equipment, Wi-Fi jamming equipment, not out of the realm of possibility. Whether they would be targeting some you know, part of my street in my neighborhood, yeah, that's where it gets a little tinfoil hat-ish, but I'm willing to accept that. Anyway, Ivor wrote me to say that, hey, I've been having similar troubles, but I am a kind of data person. I want to really analyze this. I want to gather data and try and figure out if I can understand when, where, and why this is happening. And the way he decided to do it is really ultimately what I want to talk to you about today, because I thought this was so cool. He created a shortcut, and I wouldn't have never even thought to use the Shortcuts app for this, but he created something, a shortcut called iPod Failures, and he sent me a link to it, a gallery link to it. I will have that link in the show notes at mattcast.com if you want to check this out. If you want to tweak it, if you want to make it your own, you can do that. So you can grab this. But basically what it does is it prompts you, when you fire the shortcut, it prompts you about your AirPod issue. It says, okay, which AirPod had the problem? Is it the left one, the right one? Did both have an issue? Is it some other issue? And then you can kind of type in what the issue is. And then when you do that, it then records the date, the time, and also the location on Apple Maps of where that event happened. And it takes all that data and it appends it and saves it to a note in the Notes application. So you could have this sort of running log of dates and times and locations where you had your AirPod failures, and maybe you can then start to see a pattern and start to understand maybe why it's happening. Genius stuff, really, really pretty cool. I never would have thought to use Shortcuts as a data collection tool, and at least not in this way. I know you can do things like there's built-in things for like tracking your caffeine through the health app, those sorts of things, but I thought this was really a great use case, you know, troubleshooting some sort of problem that you're having with your device. This could even be, you know, translated into if there's some sort of car problem you always have, something like that. You can, you know, what's awesome about Shortcuts is you can take this one and you can adapt it to some other need, right? You can change it, you can create it. I also thought it was really cool because I can now add this item to my widgets. I can access it from my home screen or my lock screen. I could also set up a Siri trigger for it, right? So I could say, hey, lady, my AirPods failed, and that could trigger this shortcut to run, and I could enter the data about it. And so I thought this was really neat, and it was just another example of how, you know, we can use Shortcuts. And I'm starting to use Shortcuts more and more. getting into it. It's been a slow process, but I'm really enjoying them, and I'm starting to understand the power of them, and seeing this example just gets me more excited about them. So how about you? What are you using shortcuts for? Do you have some innovative new ways that you've built shortcuts into your daily workflows and in your life? I would love to hear about these. Send us some audio comments. Let us know how you're using shortcuts. maccast@gmail.com, and we'll share these on future episodes of the MacCast. But with that, that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, PDF Pen for your iOS devices, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you, your comments, your questions. Let me know something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast. You can send those emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave voicemail there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.